So good evening. And last week I started a four-week series on the Four Noble Truths. So we'll continue that series. So just to review briefly, the Four Noble Truths are the most basic of the Buddha's teachings. He said at one point that all of his teachings could be subsumed under the Four Noble Truths. And these truths are the truth of suffering, or dukkha, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So last week I talked about the truth of suffering, or the truth of dukkha. And just as a, how many of you were not here last week? Okay, I'll just briefly mention a definition of the word dukkha for you. So dukkha, the word dukkha is translated, often translated as suffering, but it's got much more of a breadth of meaning to that in the Buddhist tradition. It encompasses all areas of unease and difficulty in our life, including the subtlest aspects of distress or dissatisfaction, all the way through massive suffering that might be associated with the death of a loved one or a diagnosis of cancer or something like that. So it really incorporates everything from the subtlest kinds of irritation through the massive rage that we experience. And what the Buddha says that dukkha or suffering is a reaction to some experience in our lives. It's an indication or a state of not having things the way we want them to be. So it's not the unpleasant event itself that's the dukkha. So if we're experiencing suffering around a painful bodily sensation, the bodily sensation itself is not the dukkha. But our reaction to it, our mental reaction to it, is what the dukkha is. So this may help some of you to understand what he means by the possibility that suffering can actually end. It doesn't mean actually that physical pain ends, but the reactivity to physical pain ends. And two, if you explore this in detail in your own practice, you will begin to see actually that the vast majority of what we call pain is actually lies in the reaction to the physical pain and not so much in the physical pain itself. It's kind of a surprising thing to see, but you can begin to see that. So that's what the Buddha was talking about when he talked about dukkha, is the reactivity in our minds of having something not be the way we want it to be. So tonight I'll talk about the second noble truth, but first I'll just also mention as a review that the Buddha didn't lay these truths out as just statements to be believed, metaphysical truths. They are truths meant to be explored in your life, truths meant to be really seen in your own life. And to that end, the Buddha actually gave actions associated with each of the truths. So he said that the noble truth of suffering is meant to be understood. So we're meant to understand suffering through the direct experience of it, so we can really see and understand about the reactivity of our minds and how that contributes to our discomfort, dissatisfaction, displeasure in our life. So the noble truth of suffering is meant to be understood. The noble truth of the cause of suffering is meant to be abandoned, and I'll talk more about that tonight. The noble truth of the cessation of suffering is meant to be realized, and the noble truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering is meant to be cultivated or developed. So I'll talk about those in the coming weeks. But before I go into the truth of the cause of suffering, I wanted to just see if there were any comments, if anybody had any experiences during the week related to the exercise I gave. I suggested you see if you could look at some suffering in your life and see what it felt like and what you could understand about it. So I wanted to just check in and see either if there's any reports or comments about that, and otherwise if there are any questions about anything that I said last week that you may have reflected on that you'd like to ask about. So I'll just open it up briefly for questions for a few minutes. That's true. It's okay, Maureen. I think I'll just repeat. It'll be easier. Yeah. So she said that the suffering is more obvious sometimes than some of the positive emotions, and that's really true. What did you discover about that?
That I had the little card for the joy and suffering.
So the suffering sort of stood out to you. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a balance in terms of what we normally do in practice, you know, to sometimes we look for the joy and sometimes we look for the suffering. And ultimately what we want to be able to do is just be able to be with whatever is happening. So it sounds like you, kind of similar to me, tend to be the type that kind of gravitates to the suffering. And that's what I did. You know, I really gravitated to the suffering, and it was very hard for me to feel any of the positive emotions. And so for me, a lot of the practice at one point was consciously noticing, oh, there's a little bit of happiness here. You know, really, really keying into that so that it helped to balance that tendency. So that sounds like it might be helpful for you. But I was wanting to see, you know, how people actually experience the suffering. So when you felt the suffering, what did you experience?
I felt it in my body a lot.
And how?
I was able to catch things before they happened. Like, I feel it in the back of my neck, certain tension coming up, before it even got to embellish things.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. So what she said was that she felt it in her body. She felt tension in her head, in her back of her neck, and that because she was feeling that, it didn't get to embellish. And that's actually one of the benefits of paying attention to the suffering, that it can cut through some of the embellishment that we proliferate on, and that actually kind of sets up the feedback loop and makes it worse. So that's great. Thank you. Any other comments?
When you talk about the suffering, is that physical sensation the suffering that you talk about in terms of dukkha, or is it the embellishments that is the dukkha?
It's more the embellishments that's the dukkha. Yeah, the first, you know, the physical contact of, you know, something like a cut, if you cut your hand with a knife, the pain associated with that is simply pain. And there's a whole series of very rapid and unseen feelings and thoughts that arise around that are very subtle, actually. Some of them are very subtle. So that, you know, if you were simply experiencing the bare sensations, you might simply experience burning, tearing, heat, searing, something along those lines, and it wouldn't actually necessarily even get to the feeling of pain. So that really, you know, it's kind of a hard question to answer in some ways, because the physical sensation itself is not pain, but there's so much of our physical sensation that we experience bound up in our reactivity to it that it's very hard to tease them apart. So a lot of what we experience as physical pain is the dukkha, actually. So I don't know if that makes any sense, but yeah.
I wasn't actually here last week, but the fact is, I just went to the past month.
Exactly. That, yes, that's exactly what I'm referring to. So what he said, just in case some of you couldn't hear it, is that he's been noticing in the last few months that if there's some kind of physical injury, that a lot of the suffering is bound up in fear about it. And that if he can notice the fear and let go of the fear, there's actually less pain. Does that summarize pretty clearly? Yeah. Thank you. That's a really good observation.
There's a lot of emotions that come up, but that, to me, I've noticed especially the fear part. I think there are other parts too. But
with physical pain, I think fear, and with illness, I think fear is a huge component. And with other situations, anger may be, you know, there can be all kinds of different reactions that we come to. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So last week, I guess what I remember you're saying is that you knew it was comprised of really three things: the event or the pain, the reaction to it, and then just kind of, I guess, the difficulties in life, you know, all the trouble, you know, having to wash the clothes, having to pay your taxes. And so it sounds like the pain, the suffering is not really avoidable, but you can start magnifying it.
The events of life are not avoidable. And the definition of suffering, you know, that's the tricky part, you know, what the actual definition of suffering is. And so just to repeat briefly, the three types of suffering I talked about were the suffering due to pain, so the suffering due to physical injury, some kind of physical, either mental or physical pain. And then there's the suffering due to when something pleasant ends. That's the second part. So if you're having a great period in your life where, you know, you're really happy and then suddenly that ends, there's suffering around the fact that that period of happiness has ended. So there's a kind of a clinging to that happiness. This is the way it's supposed to be. It's no longer that way. There's a reactivity around the fact that I'm no longer happy, or it's no longer that the situation in life isn't what I am wanting it to be. So that's the reactivity. And then the other piece was what I call the Buddhist version of existential anxiety, just the fact that we kind of have to take care of our bodies and that we have to get ourselves out of bed and work and all of these things. And there's just this sense of, wow, is this all there is? Kind of that sense of, what is the meaning here? So that's the third one. And you can't get rid of the unpleasant experiences. You can't get rid of the pleasant experiences, and you can't get rid of the neutral experiences. But the reactivity to those experiences can be seen through, and then the suffering will be. I mean, ultimately, according to the Buddhist tradition, the suffering can be completely eliminated at full enlightenment. But even in my experience, the suffering around life can be greatly reduced just through the day-to-day practice.
Pain, mandatory, suffering, optional?
That's one way to put it. Pain, mandatory. Pain is mandatory when it happens, but the suffering is optional. So I'll go ahead now and start talking about the second noble truth, the truth of the cause of suffering. So first of all, we should just notice this truth states that suffering has a cause. Before even jumping to ask what the cause is, the fact that this truth states that suffering has a cause, that's important in its own right. So suffering is not a random event in our lives. The Buddha taught that our actions have consequences, and that the intention associated with those actions results in a tendency towards certain types of consequences. He didn't state that certain actions have determined results. It's not a deterministic teaching. But if you generally act with wholesome intention, with skillful intention, with intentions of love, of generosity, of kindness, then the tendency will be for you to have more positive results in your life. if the intentions you act with are out of anger, aversion, or greed, then it will tend to rebound on you and to have negative consequences in your life. Now, this is the Buddhist teaching on karma, and it's a whole talk in and of itself, and I'm not going to go into it in detail. But I just wanted to mention here that the Buddha taught that we have a choice in our actions, and that's actually the teaching of karma, that our actions have consequences, and the choice that we make can alter the results of those consequences. So we can alter the unfolding of our life through the choices we make in the present moment. So we can alter our suffering through the choices we make right now. And I'll talk more about that in a moment. So suffering has a cause, and the Buddha said that the cause of the suffering, in Pali the term is tanha, and that term translated literally means thirst. So this gives us a little bit of an indication about the nature of the cause of suffering. It's often translated as craving or desire. Or wanting. But the term thirst, I think, helps to convey a little bit of the nature of the feeling there. It's one, when we're thirsty, if we're really thirsty, there's a kind of a biological imperative to get something to drink. It's a real need. The body physically needs that thing. And so in craving, there's a sense of needing, of needing things to be different than they are. There's a real neediness in the feeling of craving. So not all desire is bad. In fact, a form of desire actually fuels our spiritual practice. So what we need to be on the lookout for is this kind of desire that has this kind of neediness, this feeling of, oh, this just is not the way things should be. I need this to be a different way. When we think of wanting or desire, we usually think of things we want to have. That tends to be the way we think of the word wanting. But in the sense of the Second Noble Truth, the cause of suffering, this wanting also includes not wanting or wanting to not have. So it includes both this desire, this wanting to grasp and hold on to, and this movement of pushing away, of wanting to get rid of. So just be aware that wanting when I speak about it, or craving when I speak about it, includes both movements. So these movements of wanting and not wanting, or of desire and aversion, are rooted in a very simple aspect of our lives. I talked a few minutes ago about pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Well, these movements of wanting and not wanting are rooted in the experience of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. In a very simple and natural way, when something is pleasant, we like it and we want it. When something is unpleasant, we don't like it and we want to get rid of it. So our lives are kind of fueled by this process. So a very simple example, you know, just to give you a sense of this. When I was a kid, I loved candy. And when I went, when it was Halloween, I loved Halloween, and I would go out trick-or-treating and get all this candy, and I'd come home and I'd just start eating the candy. I would have eaten it until I got sick. But fortunately, my mother stopped me. But the pleasant of the candy was what I was after, you know, that pleasant feeling. If I had kept eating it until I had gotten sick, there would have been an unpleasant sensation, and I would have stopped. So in a very simple way, our lives kind of reflect that. Now, our lives are more complicated than Halloween candy, but in that principle of pleasant, liking, wanting, unpleasant, not liking, wanting to push away, underlies the vast majority of our actions in the world. And it happens often at a non-conscious level. We're not really aware of what it is that's happening. But the surprising thing that happens when we actually start observing wanting in our lives is that we see that the wanting itself, it's the wanting itself that's the source of our suffering, and not the object that we want. So, for instance, if you've just made a presentation at work and you think it's a great presentation, but your boss didn't say anything, there may be a sense of, I'm unhappy or dissatisfied somehow or feel dismissed because my boss didn't compliment me on the presentation. So we're usually focused on the object, or we attribute our suffering to something in the world. We think we're unhappy because our boss didn't do something. It's harder to see that our dissatisfaction, our sense of frustration or feeling dismissed, results really from wanting the compliment and not so much from the fact that it didn't come. So just to follow on this example of Halloween candy with another example about candy, a very simple example to give you the sense of how wanting works. Think of a chocolate craving. Many of us have had that kind of experience of craving chocolate. So if we crave a piece of chocolate and we eat the chocolate, the craving goes away. Often that craving will go away once we've had the chocolate. We've seen this kind of experience happen so much in our lives that when we want something and we get it, the dissatisfaction goes away and we're happy. We think that the reason that we're happy is because we've gotten the thing that we wanted. But in actuality, the main reason that we're happy is because the dissatisfaction has ended. So this kind of experience happens over and over in our lives. This cycle of suffering, wanting, having relief. Suffering, wanting, having relief. We get the relief from something and then some other thing happens and there's a new suffering, a new wanting, a new having, a new relief. It just is this round in our lives. And actually at some point we start wanting things to want, because we feel like that if we get something that we want, we get happy. So we begin to want things. And because we've seen this so many times, that the relief comes off of the having, we start to think that's the only way to end our dissatisfaction. So the Buddha described this round of suffering that I talked about, the suffering, the wanting, the having, and the relief, in a teaching called the Teaching on Dependent Origination. And this is a very detailed description of how suffering is created in our lives. I won't go into this in full detail, but I'll just cover a little bit of it so that you can kind of get the flavor of it. So basically, because we have a body and a mind, we've got this body and we've got this mind, functioning mind, we've got consciousness and we've got sense doors, we've got eyes, we've got ears, there's contact. Some object impinges on the senses. So for instance, if we see a rose, there's the contact of the object, there's the light that passes through our eyes, there's contact in the sense door, and the seeing occurs. So that's the first two links. There's the body and mind, and then there's the contact. From that contact, there is inevitably a feeling tone that arises from that contact. It's either pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neutral. This isn't an emotional thing I'm talking about here. It's very basic, very fundamental tone of experience with every experience that we have. It's either pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neutral. So that's the third link. Based on that experience of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, there's a little reactivity that arises. If it's pleasant, we like it and we want it. If it's unpleasant, we don't like it, we don't want it, we want to push it away. If it's neutral, we may just completely space out and not even notice it's there. So with this example of the rose, we see the rose, there's the contact of the rose with our eye. For most of us, probably a rose is pleasant. We may like it, want to have the rose, cut it from the bush, and take it away with us. That's the having. That's called clinging. And we probably experience a few moments of happiness having the thing, you know, feeling of, oh, isn't it nice that I have this rose? I can put it on my desk and see it tomorrow morning and it'll bloom, it'll open, it'll be lovely. So there's some feeling of satisfaction about having the rose. But as the rose fades, the pleasure fades. So there's a natural lessening of the pleasure of having the rose. So in that situation, we may then go out and find another rose because the rose is no longer so pleasant to look at. That's a very simple example of the chain that we get into, the cycle. Suffering, having, suffering, wanting, having, relief. Suffering, wanting, having, relief. But the genius of the Buddha was to discover that the wanting itself is the source of our suffering and not the fact that we don't get what we want. It's the ending of the wanting that is the ending of, that brings the happiness, rather than the attainment of our object of desire. So one of the joys of meditation practice, and this may sound a little strange, but one of the joys of meditation practice is actually learning to watch our desires and just watch them come and go. What happens is that you start to see that desire is an impermanent event. It's not something that stays. Now, sometimes it feels that way. Sometimes desires can be so strong, they really feel like, unless I get what I want, I'm just going to go crazy. But a desire is like anything else. It has a life. It arrives, it stays for a certain period of time, and then it passes away. If you can notice that desire, if you can notice the desire disappearing, if you can notice that feeling of just intense leaning in and wanting an object, wanting something, wanting to have, if you can notice that disappearing, you can feel a sense of relief, like you've been released from a vice grip. I had this experience pretty clearly on one retreat. It was a 3-month retreat that I was doing, and I was doing a lot of walking meditation outside, and a lot of people were walking outside. And I was practicing very carefully what we called sense restraint, so not looking around too much, not engaging myself in the world too much. So I was, you know, walking with my eyes about 6 feet in front of me on the ground and just keeping my attention there. And I began to notice as I was walking like this that I really, when somebody would walk by, you know, you can kind of see them with your peripheral vision, so you know that there's people around. And when somebody would walk by, I really wanted to look at them. I could just feel that, you know, the sense of kind of having to force my head to stay put so that it wouldn't move and look at these people as they were walking by. For a while, that's what I did. I just forced my head. I'm not going to give in to this wanting. I'm not going to give in to this wanting. And at some point, I realized, oh, this is what's happening. Wanting is what's happening in the moment. So I should pay attention to that. I mean, I had 3 months to figure this out, so it took me a while to figure out wanting was what was happening. It seemed obvious telling the story, but so I started paying attention to the wanting. What did it feel like? And so as I would notice that the wanting would appear when somebody arrived in my peripheral vision, and I would feel this just pull in my body, you know, like, I really want to look. Just this, it was a physical sensation of wanting to look. It was very unpleasant. The wanting itself, when we actually experience it, is unpleasant. And that gives us a key as to why we want to get rid of it. We want to get rid of unpleasant things. So I just was noticing this and noticing that pull, noticing it. And at some point I began to notice that the wanting would appear when somebody appeared in my peripheral vision, and it would disappear when they left my peripheral vision. I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, and I kind of got into it after a while. It's like, it was such a a little bit of joy in that moment when the wanting disappeared. It's like, poof, oh, I'm free from that wanting. And so I just kind of got into it. It was fun doing the walking meditation and seeing the wanting come and build, and then poof, it would go away. And at some point, after some days of this, I saw the wanting arise, and then there was a recognition, because I'd seen this over and over. I'd seen the wanting disappear over and over again. There was this recognition, oh, this is just going to go away. And this was, it was kind of a thought, but it was something that happened it was kind of an intuitive thing that happened. So there was the recognition, the wanting arose, and there was a recognition, this is just going to go away. Why do I need to hold on to it? And it disappeared immediately, even though the person was still in my vision. And from that point on, the wanting to see other people, wanting to look at other people, was gone. It just didn't arise again after that point. So that's an example of how we can actually learn from our wanting and see. I learned about impermanence. I learned about how wanting functions. We can really get some very deep insights through observing wanting. So we learn by watching our desires come and go, and sometimes they don't. I mean, this was over the space of weeks I'm talking about, you know, observing this wanting. And sometimes certain kinds of wanting are really ingrained in our habits. We have a lot of habitual patterns, and some of those patterns involve wanting. And so sometimes we have to observe this wanting for a long time. But we can begin to see, especially in simpler kinds of wanting, that desire is impermanent, and that there's another way to end our suffering than by getting what we want. The letting go or the abandoning of the wanting is also a way towards happiness. So this brings us to the action that the Buddha associated with the Second Noble Truth. The cause of suffering is meant to be abandoned. So this letting go or this abandoning of wanting can be an active kind of recognition. Oh, this is not useful. I can let go of this. There can be a sense of that active letting go or dropping something when we see it. When we see the wanting, we see it's unskillful. Sometimes we can simply say, that's not useful. I'm going to let it go. Sometimes that can happen. But this letting go process also includes not acting on the desire. So we let go of the desire to act on it and simply observe it. That is also included in this idea of abandoning wanting. We abandon the action on the wanting and simply observe it. We simply feel it in our body. We feel what it feels like in our mind. We notice its unpleasantness. We notice where we experience it. We learn our patterns around it. We learn over time that if we function with our desires in this way, that they will eventually go away. Sometimes they go away faster than others, but they will eventually disappear. Because they are impermanent, these desires will eventually disappear. So the wanting will actually let go of itself if we simply leave it alone. Last week I read from a sutta where the Buddha talked about a wise person in living their life reflects, this is suffering. This is the cause of suffering. And I just like to go back to that for a moment. Part of what this sutta, with this excerpt of the sutta, points out to us is that suffering occurs in the present moment. This, what I'm experiencing right now, is suffering. This is suffering. This wanting right now. This is the cause of suffering. So suffering occurs in the present moment. It doesn't occur in the past. It doesn't occur in the future. It occurs right now. Often we suffer over things that have happened in the past or suffer over things we think might happen in the future. But the suffering is happening right now. It's reflected right now in our bodies. It's reflected right now in our emotions and our thoughts. So another example of this. Some years ago, I was in a play, and one night in the performance, I forgot a line. And I tried to compensate by making up other lines and, you know, but the other actors didn't pick up the cue, and then there was this just awful, awful pause where I couldn't think of any more things to say. And there was just this silence, this awful silence, this just feeling of death, you know. It was horrible. For many years afterwards, when something would occur to trigger that memory, that feeling just came back. That just, oh, embarrassment, sinking, horrible. It was right there. And on one retreat, 1 3-month retreat, that memory came back over and over and over again. And I relived that horrible feeling so many times. But finally, I got to really see what was happening. A memory would occur that would trigger the thought of the event, and then there'd be a reaction in that moment, a reaction to that memory. It was simply a reaction to the memory in the present moment. The conditions for the suffering, the cause, the conditions, the situation that created the conditions for the suffering were in the past, the actual event that happened. But the suffering that I was experiencing right then was happening right then. It happened because a thought triggered a thought, which triggered a reaction. So not only does suffering occur in the present moment, but also so does wanting. The wanting itself occurs in the present moment. So again, even though the conditions are set up in the past, the cause, the direct cause, is something in the moment, wanting something to be different. So another example, last week I talked a little bit about anger that I experienced at one point in my practice. It was quite a bit of anger I was experiencing. And I had spent quite a bit of time just observing anger and what it felt like to be angry. I really, really got to understand the suffering of anger through being with it over and over and over again. And one day in this process, I was in my kitchen, you know, things were fine, you know, I was pretty normal, happily neutral, and I was cutting an apple. And I was fairly mindful, although not intentionally so necessarily, but I was cutting the apple, and I noticed that a thought occurred in the mind. It was a thought about the person that I was angry with, and we were together at a fruit stand in the Sacramento area. And I could see that the memory was triggered from the event. It was triggered from the apple that I was cutting. There was a connection between the action that I was doing and the memory. And I could also see, this was happening pretty rapidly, what I'm describing, I could see that I wasn't angry at the moment, but I could see this, like this urge in my mind or body. It was just this feeling of wanting to get angry at this person who had arisen in my mind because I had reason to be angry with him. But I saw, and I'm knowing, having experienced so much anger and seen how much that anger caused suffering in my own body and mind, the mind just kind of saw that where it was going. This wasn't something I had to do, but it saw that if I got on that thought, if I got on that thought and just thought myself into anger, that I would suffer. And in that seeing that direction would head me into suffering, the mind just let go of it, said, not going there. And I didn't get angry. And that really blew me away because it was the first time in many, many months that this person had come into my mind and had not immediately been associated with anger. And it was so startling to me, and it was one of the early is probably my earliest seeing, really, of the Second Noble Truth, how that wanting would cause suffering and how the mind would just abandon it. The mind would simply abandon it, seeing that that's where it would go. It really, that experience generated a tremendous amount of faith in the practice, because I could see in that moment that had I not been mindful, I would have been in anger. So it really let me understand how the practice itself could extricate me from the suffering that I had been experiencing, particularly around this anger. So I'd like to do a little guided reflective meditation. I taught this last week, but I'll give a little a description again of how it goes. So what we do with this reflective practice is that we settle ourselves for a few minutes, you know, just a couple minutes, in silence. You can just come back to your breathing and just let yourself get still and quiet as much as possible. And into this stillness, I'll say a couple of words. And what your job is to notice how you react to those words. What happens in your body? What happens in your mind? Do you have any physical reaction, any tension or tightness in your body, or relaxation in your body? Are there thoughts that arise? As much as possible, keep just coming back to the word and don't proliferate or think about what happens. Just notice, oh, I'm feeling a pressure here, a tension here, a tightness, a squeezing. Oh, I'm having a thought about this. Come back. So as much as possible, just keep coming back to the word and to the stillness as much as possible. This is a way that you can use in your own practice to reflect on a subject from a non-thinking perspective. You can use the stillness to see how your body resonates with a particular topic, and it can give you some information you might not otherwise get if you were just thinking about it. So we'll just start with a couple of minutes of sitting, and then I'll just mention a few words. wanting. 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 Release. So I'll take some comments and reports about that in just a minute. But I want to just make a couple of suggestions for some things to try for next week. So see if you can observe wanting. Get familiar what it's like to want in the present moment. It can be something simple, you know, like wanting to eat because you're hungry, or even wanting to go to the bathroom. I mean, I'm not talking about necessarily writing out these desires, but just to get the feeling, what does it feel like to want in your body? What does it feel like to want to get up and take a walk? You know, just notice before you do something if there's a feeling of wanting, and what does that feel like? So just to get a familiarity with what wanting feels like. And just very simply, you know, just briefly notice in the body if there's any tightness or tension, and if there's any particular thoughts about in the mind, maybe there's some emotions of impatience or desire or greed or something in the mind associated with it. So just see what you can notice about it in a simple way, and then let it go. You know, this isn't a big deal that I'm talking about here. And then maybe try once or twice to actually ride out a desire like I talked about. Don't act on something. Pick something very innocuous, like wanting to have a candy bar or something like that, you know. If you notice some simple thing that, you know, well, you know, I could probably do without those extra calories, you know, just see if you can notice the wanting and notice that at some point the wanting is gone. It may be that what happens is that you notice at some point, you know, that you have gone off to do something else, and that you notice when you're in the midst of doing something else, oh, that desire is now gone. You didn't actually see it disappear, but you now notice that it's not there anymore. That's great if you can see that. If you can actually see it disappear, that's wonderful. And if anybody can see that, let me know. And one good way to work on this is in your sitting meditation, and I'd like to suggest an exercise that Jack Kornfield suggests. I'll read the description of it. It's from his book, A Path with Heart. And it's a meditation on what moves us, what makes us want to move. So here's the instructions he gives. In your daily meditation practice, make a resolve for 1 week that you will not get up until a strong impulse to do so arises 3 times. Sit as you usually would, being mindful of your breath, body, and mind, but do not set a fixed time for the end of your meditation. Instead, sit until a strong impulse tells you to get up. Notice its quality. It may arise from restlessness, from hunger, from knee pain, from thinking about how much you have to do, the need to go to the bathroom. Softly name the energy that has arisen, and with it sense the impulse wanting to move. Feel it carefully in your body, naming wanting to get up, wanting to get up, staying with it for as long as it lasts. He says parenthetically, this rarely lasts more than a minute. And I have found that to be true. I don't know if everyone finds that to be true. Then after this impulse has passed, notice what it feels like now and if your meditation has deepened from sitting through the whole impulse process. Continue to sit until a second impulse to arise pulls you strongly. Notice the whole process in the same way as before. Finally, after a third time of carefully being with the whole impulse process, allow yourself to get up. The depth of your attention and centeredness will gradually grow through this process. So this gives you a very structured way to observe wanting. You've got a particular activity that you're doing, and you know that at some point you'll want to end it. And actually observe that wanting process 3 times before you actually end it. If you find that too challenging, just observe it once before you end it. But give yourself a chance to see whether it's true that wanting to get up will actually disappear 1 time, and then get up the second time it arises. It's a very powerful meditation, and you can also apply it to an impulse to itch or to move in your meditation. You know, that feeling of wanting to itch. You can watch that wanting. Sometimes the wanting is worse than anything else. Like, it's worse than the pain, it's worse than the itch. The wanting just feels as bad as the itch. So notice the wanting and see if you can, even for just a few seconds, you know, for 10 seconds before you scratch the itch, notice what it feels like to want to scratch the itch before you do it, so that you can get a sense of what wanting feels like. So those are my suggestions for exercises for next week. And just wanted to open it up to see if anybody had any comments about the reflective practice that we did, if there's anything there, or if anything else about anything that I've said tonight. Yeah.
Well, the first time you said one thing, there was this sinking feeling, and it disappeared with the next 2 repetitions. Like, okay, you've heard that.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, and there was pretty much, that was it.
Uh-huh.
It was nothing.
Okay, that's fine. Anyone else have anything to say? Huh?
I'm just noticing that I wanted the word.
Before I said it? That's great. I have to repeat that. So what she said was she noticed that she was wanting the word. So she was noticing that. I was like, wow, it's been a long time. Is this the wanting that she was talking about? That's beautiful. Thank you. So what did you notice about it?
The desire for it.
Uh-huh. That's great. great. So did you feel it in your body? Did you feel
it? I felt it in my body, but it was just a pull in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Uh-huh.
Right. Well, these things happen in various ways for different people, so this is great. That's beautiful. Thank you. Anyone else?
I kept saying the word, oh, I'm wanting this, I'm wanting that. When you said wanting, I thought, oh my God, it's just like repeating in my head. And when you said the word, I thought, oh, like tinges, physical.
Did anybody have any reaction to the word release? Was there anything that a couple of you?
That's what I felt.
And you? What was your reaction? Just to letting go? Or?
It was, it felt good. The wanting felt like a contraction.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a mental image, and as thoughts would come in with it too, they always tended to be sort of contracted things. And then I go back to just the word, it just felt like something getting smaller and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Like release just felt very immediately, the moment that the word hit my ears, just expansive.
Mm-hmm.
If I get like an out breath, it's just really.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I actually found myself wanting release. You said release.
Oh, so it was not immediately there.
More
it was more wanting. Yeah, well, sometimes that can happen, you know. Sometimes we can't let go immediately, you know. A lot of our experience in the meditation practice is being with the wanting and feeling like, I would let go of this if I knew how, you know. But just to keep observing it and trusting that it has its own process to let go. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that sounds like a little bit of fear there.
I have that sometimes in my meditation where I get attached to being here in the meditation and I feel the need to just get up because I don't want to be attached to it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I get almost reactive to, like, afraid to cling to release.
Yeah. It's a tricky area, and I'd encourage you to see if you can let go into the release and notice, as opposed to getting up, notice that movement of mind that says, I don't want to cling to this, I don't want to get attached to this. Notice that. You know, notice that piece, because that's what's happening, is that aversion to getting lost in or aversion to having to have that feeling. Yeah. So just notice that instead of getting up. You know, spend a few minutes there in that place. Any other comments? Well, it's 9:00, so. I forgot to mention last week that I have compiled some sutta references for the subject that we're talking about. And I can email them to any of those who are interested. So if you're interested, come up and give me your email address, and I will email you these sutta references, some of which I've been reading through here, and others of which are just ones that I felt were very descriptive of what we're talking about. So if any of you are interested in that, I would be happy to email those to you. I'll see you sometime soon. Thank you for your attention.